Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 20th of July, 2021. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on board and good to see so many people on. More coming, I see, as we chat. Very good to spend some of the Tuesday evening with you tonight. Just before I bring Tony in, let me just remind you that, as normal, this isn't financial advice. It's a general conversation. We don't know your individual circumstances. Do please play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs. We do moderate the stream. I do encourage interaction between the various people chatting, but no racial slurs, please. This is as at the 20th of July, 2021, if you're watching in replay. If you'd like to get my attention, do use at Walk the World. That's the best way to make sure that your question goes to the top of the queue and gets spotted. And I have enabled Super Chat, which essentially does two things. You can get your question right at the top of the queue by using Super Chat, or indeed if you'd like to make a general donation to support our work, that would be much appreciated. We don't do this for profit, but more to do because we think it's really important. So if you're able to help us, that's fantastic. And with that introduction as normal, let me, without further ado, push this button and bring Tony LeCantro in. Tony, are you there?
G'day, Martin, and g'day to the audience. It has been a while, but I'll run through the reason why shortly in the slideshow I've put together.
Yeah, well, great, Tony, and good to see you back. And, you know, I said before you came on, sometimes real life intrudes, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, it certainly does, and that's brought to light why I think that looking after your finances and family is going to be extremely important, and that there are going to be some unforeseen life events that get in the way, and I don't think that we've ever seen a more critical time for that to occur. And you know, my life kind of been thrown upside down the last month, but you know, you realise you just got to get on with things and stick to what you believe in, stick to your plans. And hopefully tonight I can just give a broad overview to viewers where to invest, where am I putting my money, my clients' money, and the risk involved, because this is certainly probably the most challenging economic times I think we're going to have this generation, leading into what possibly could be the darkest time. So anyway, bring it on, Martin.
Well, yes, I mean, I have said a few times, and I'll say it again, I think you're right. Now, the degree of uncertainty and the multifaceted dimensionality around what's going on, I don't think I can recall a time like it. You know, I've been around for quite a long time. We've tended to have single issues to deal with, whereas there's such a complex matrix of issues now. And it does make investing and everything else, you know, really very complicated. And I think one of the things I keep coming back to, Tony, is that, you know, really nobody's going to be very sure about much for quite some time. And that is an uncomfortable place to be.
Well, there's no economic precedent for where we are now. And there's no manual. I mean, it's like trying to land an A380 without landing gear. There's just nothing there that can suggest where we go from here in the economy. All we can do is adopt the brace position and hope for a soft landing. But certainly with the way the world is, interest rates at 0.1, markets still near record highs, and you know, the sheer stupidity of what's going on, certainly there's no precedent for this. So I can tell you what, the aliens or future generations for hundreds of years are certainly going to have a laugh about where we are right now.
Yeah, and I'm sure there'll be a few films made of it. And things like that down the track, right? But yeah. I suspect that in the short term, people will be a bit fed up with more talk about lockdowns, et cetera, et cetera. And look, it's just worth reflecting, right? Because in the UK, they've sort of opened everything up, but the spread rate's going up. There's talk about the US. And it's interesting that the markets basically started to correct today. And you know, a bit last week, but it's all because suddenly the inflation thing sort of disappeared as a major concern, and everyone's waking up to the fact that this ain't over until it's over. And that, I guess, is the point. This could go on for quite some time, and who knows quite where it's going to end up.
Oh, exactly. And I think the lesson I've learned is not to make plans. I've just had to cancel some holidays. all my concerts are getting cancelled. Look, it's hardly a first world problem, but I just think that people are going to be nervous about booking an overseas trip, trying to travel. And again, you know, this COVID has thrown everything into disarray. I mean, you could have chosen Adelaide as a dirty weekend destination, and suddenly South Australia's in lockdown. So it's like playing, avoiding the lockdowns. But yeah, anyway, certainly challenging times. But what I've done tonight, Martin, I put together a brief slideshow. It's in the typical Lacantro style. Actually, this slideshow contains less words than what I've ever written in a slideshow, and I'd rather just talk to pictures rather than bore everyone with wordy slides. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to start run through it.
Yeah, go for your life. You've got control. So over to you, Tony.
Righty then. All right, let's see if this works.
Yep, it's happening.
Okay, so yeah, investing now. So what I intend to do is run through pretty much a number of investment classes to hopefully provide a guide for viewers for some future research, which is the plan. So there's the disclaimer. This is general advice. Pretty much I'm not taking into consideration anyone's circumstances that is viewing this production. I'd suggest you seek independent financial advice, whether that be your Uber driver, guy at the TAB, or bikini model that has a hot tip for you. So consult them. They probably know more than me. So again, that's a general advice warning. Now, I've been off the social media scene for quite some time. And sadly, on the 24th of June, my father passed away. It was quite a brief time in hospital. He went to hospital 5 days before, and they believed that he had pancreatic cancer that had spread, and he was in such a bad state that they couldn't do a biopsy on him. So I managed to go into hospital and hold his hand every day. And there's Mum holding his hand. Dad was a stubborn old bastard. He basically wanted to look after Mum till his last breath. Mum was 4 years into Alzheimer's. So the day after Dad died, I put Mum into an aged care facility specialising in dementia. So that's been my last month. But yeah, certainly challenging. And I just thought it'd be straight up with the truth as to let people know what's been happening. But certainly learnt a lot about the aged care system. I've got my own advice there. Hopefully when I go in one day, I'd like to go in broke. I would have liked to have spent all my money on alcohol, women, fast cars and the rest. And interestingly, my father was quite a tough man. He was the most conservative person you'll ever meet financially. When I went through the house, I found ledgers where he'd written down every cent he spent, from a newspaper to a coffee. Everything was handwritten. And a week before he died, he said, "Son, I don't know how to order a pizza online." So I was quite proud to pick him up 3 pizzas online. And I guess he was the typical old school person that didn't have a lot of debt, saved and paid everything off. We'd often have a joke that he didn't really like what I do for a living. He thought that what I do is kind of a fugazi, you know, a bit of an illusion. And he would always say, "Look, son, get a real job." I was a cop for 8 years. I've been a financial advisor, broker for 23. But he often said that I take too many risks. Now, he was a bit of a hypocrite because he was actually made national dealer manager for Audi. And Dad often boasted about sitting on a freeway between 200 and 260 kilometres an hour. And I'll ask the audience, honestly, who was the real risk taker in life? So anyway, that's where I've been the last month. So what I've seen now with investments is that the population, the uneducated population, are looking to get into what I call a lobster pot or cray pot for those in WA. This is pretty much investments that are easy to get into and good luck getting out of them. And I think there, that's the gravity lesson. And I think that's a terribly hard lesson that's about to, you know, encroach on society, because it's okay to push things to high prices, but try and get the hell out. And that, and a recent example of that was Dogecoin, where Elon Musk and the Reddit crowd were saying, let's push it to a dollar. They almost succeeded relatively. They got it to about 73 cents, but there was no follow through people to buy it. And I guess what you're seeing is inexperienced speculators, inexperienced investors cheerleading an asset class, but not realizing that at some point you're going to have to get the hell out. Now, speaking of getting the hell out, I owe this next slide to Cookie Boy, who's probably orchestrating the chat room as we speak. And what's fairly clear is that, you know, 50 kilometres from Sydney with a gentle sea breeze, people are still paying ridiculous prices for real estate. And I think that that trend really has continued on. And it's going to be a case of you're really going to cop the nasty side of the correction. I'm expecting 30% plus Sydney, Melbourne off the more blue chip suburbs, those inner city. But when you start to head out towards 50 kilometres, those prices are absolutely ridiculous. And you can actually pick up a decent place around Leaderville in WA, which is Perth, which is about 4 kilometres from the city, for those prices. So I think we're going to see that trend continue. And I love the one where young people can suddenly buy 26 houses. I think the press love these. They're never going to run a story on someone that has built up a blue chip portfolio over 10 years or has been successful in building businesses from the ground up that aren't tech related. And again, you know, you see neglected houses that are selling for stupid prices, and the press love to jump all over these. And I think that, you know, these things are going to continue, but the cracks certainly are starting to appear. And this slide, I think, is an absolute classic and can relate to more than the one market. So you have a look at that property in Newtown, sold in November 2018, and then recently passed in at auction for that ridiculous price. And I think at some point it'll be more like, you know, passed out at auction. But that just goes to show you the absolute stupidity and expectations that are factored into the market. And you can also look at that slide as a case of being, you know, you can apply that to the stock market, where an asset has gone to ridiculous levels and people have massive expectations, but they refuse to sell it because they don't get top dollar. So I think that's certainly reflective of where we are in the market at present. And it's just beyond ridiculous. And I think this is going to be, you know, some classic examples where future generations studying economics are just going to, they're going to say, well, what drugs were we on? And again, you know, we've got a market where rents are actually quite cheap. 5 years lower rents. So these yields must be absolutely hideous. And the key is to actually get a return on renting out a property. And if you have a look back, any historical yields really have to be gross over 5%. And in some cases, some calculators would say, look, you know, you need a gross yield of about 10%. So I think that's reflective of the oversupply of rental properties, which makes real estate investment, especially in these major capital cities, extremely unattractive. I think the next slide is a good one. It shows that people are going to the bank of mum and dad, which, as Martin has suggested, is the 9th largest lender in the country. And there's a recent article from Scott Pape, and he says that pretty much that Martin said that most of the youth that take the loans off the parents are actually going to default in the first 5 years. And I think that's an absolutely critical point where the average loan size now is $90,000. And I think, you know, it's an absolute piss take that kids can go and ask their parents for a $90,000 loan to buy a house where it's just going to end up being a domino effect. And I know for a fact, if my 19-year-old daughter came to me and asked for a loan, I'd tell her exactly where to go. And my other advice would be just simply wait 5 years. Don't be ashamed to rent. She lives in outer Western Sydney. So again, probably a good 5 years and should throw up some bargains. And, you know, she should start looking around that East Dubbo, East Broken Hill area. So I think that's, you know, an excellent point that Scott Pape has reiterated from Martin, that we are in quite a vulnerable situation with the amount of lending carried out by the bank of mum and dad. Now, the next slide, I've used it before. It basically sums up the market where every investment class looks like someone in a Robert Palmer video. And there's the Reddit guy with the aptly named T-shirt, Game Over. So we've had this incredible period in markets where every investment class has looked attractive. Every woman in that video, let's face it, we'd probably take home. For the ladies, well, I haven't got another example, sorry. But it's a case of you've got to work out which model in that video isn't going to take 80% of your money. And sadly, that's what's going to happen in a lot of these asset classes. And I'm actually repeating a slide that Martin included yesterday. And that's from Hamish Douglas, who runs Magellan. And he was quite scathing on Bitcoin. I'm not going to be quite as scathing because it's developed some credibility. It does have quite some huge price rises and falls. And I guess those looking in that sector are certainly going to trade Bitcoin and some of the lesser cryptocurrencies out there. But that's quite a big statement from someone that runs a lot of money, is old school. But again, it just shows how irrational markets certainly have become when we have a lot of these products where you don't need a prospectus and we have porn stars promoting all types of alternate coins. And it, you know, the situation has just been exacerbated by cheap money and the desire to gamble. So what I'm also seeing in both the crypto and stock market is the financial influencers. So we have a combination of financial influencers. We have steady people in the market. So there we have a mixture of bikini models, TikTok people, Bernard Salt, who is a respected demographer in the demographics. We have Scott Phillips as well. So what I've noticed is that in the investment world, it's become quite a massive trend to have bikini models and porn stars promoting investment products. Like, we all had a chuckle. I think it was about 15 plus years ago where David Boone was actually promoting a Tasmanian mining company. And I just think with TikTok, Instagram, we're just seeing an absolute proliferation of promotion. And this is certainly, you know, it's going to attract a new breed of investor / speculator. And, you know, we have figures suggest that one in four Australians are either invested or considering speculating in crypto. So I think that's certainly going to be the trend. And I look back at the dot-com bubble. So I just come out of the New South Wales police, straight into an advising job. And then we went into the probably one of the most ridiculous bubbles of our generation, which was dot-com. But this was led mainly by rock star tech investors and people that pushed the products on financial forums, but nothing like what we're seeing today, where we have models, people honestly that don't have enough financial experience really to be seen as influencing others. And I've been at this advising game for about 23 years now. I've worked my backside off, but I just don't have a six pack. I don't look like Channing Tatum. I'm not going to be on Magic Mike 3, so you won't see me in any of these conferences. But I think that's the trend, and that's where a lot of money is going to be lost in the future. So now we have a look at markets. So that's the US market. As you can see, pretty much just off its all-time high at the moment. And it's amazing that an index of the top 30 companies in the US can be just off its record high when we're going to no doubt have earnings pressure. We're going to have inflationary pressures emerging as well. And look, the next strain of COVID, Delta, we're going to have to be faced with more lockdowns. We're going to be faced with greater challenges. And it's just ironic that probably all the good news in related to our economic recovery is already factored into the stock market. And a lot of inexperienced investors will say, well, why is the market falling on what appears to be good news? But I think there's so much good news already baked into the US market that I think the chances of it melting up are quite low. It will have some great nights to the upside, but you're also going to see more of these 700 point drops. And what I try and reiterate to my clients is that markets can fall from any level. You can go from grossly overvalued and still have a nasty correction, and markets could even drop from undervalued levels to even more undervalued levels. So there's always the fear of a market crash from a high level, but serious market corrections can occur from every level. And if we have a look at the ASX 200, again, that chart's probably a little bit exacerbated with the COVID crunch. But again, the Australian market, the major 200 companies on an index basis, we're not far off all-time highs. And I think that this fact almost fully factors in an economic recovery. It almost factors in a full transition from pre-COVID to post-COVID. And there's again, with the US market, there's a lot of good news already factored in. So I see some downside risks emerging. And again, new investors will say, well, hey, why is the stock market falling when the news is good? But again, there's always the chance of the economy spluttering. And I think one of the greatest risks with the Australian economy is interest rates. And already we're seeing the inclination that New Zealand will lift rates sooner rather than later. And I think you've got to look at the characteristics of the bubble in the Auckland property market, other property markets, and their stock market as well. And I think it's a fearful aspect of where we could head. So certainly watch out for what happens in New Zealand. And the other country to watch with their interest rate policy, of course, would be Canada. So looking at some investment classes, looking at the major resource companies, BHP has had a record year due to iron ore. Rio has performed well. We're just starting to see some M&A in the oil sector with the proposed merger between Santos and Oil Search. I actually see risk to the downside in the major resource companies, even though you're going to see advertisements saying that, you know, we're going to need copper for electronic vehicles, we're going to need nickel. But I think that these companies have had fantastic runs. Some supply constraints have held up and been supported of commodity prices. So I do see downside pressure in our major resource companies, and I'd certainly be taking profits. The banking sector, from the COVID crunch lows, a number of banks have doubled their share prices. I think now that the risk is certainly to the downside. But what I would suggest, I know that there's quite some conservative investors out there, that maybe one of the best approaches when you look at financial stocks is to dollar cost average into the market, realizing that you're probably buying at a reasonably high level and then looking to buy as the market continues to drop. I mean, I personally wouldn't be doing that, but we do have investors out there that are searching for yield, looking for their 5-6% plus in yield. If that was the case, I'd certainly be looking outside the banks. I'd be looking more towards the gambling stocks and growth stocks, but obviously that would have ethical issues as well. Gold and silver. Gold has been an excellent store of wealth. It's helped people maintain purchasing power. The Australian gold price is still around $2,400 an ounce, and it has performed. A number of our gold producers are still able to make around $1,000 an ounce. So I would probably expect another round of M&A in the sector. Silver is always touted as the next big thing. I still think that that is certainly a commodity slash precious metal that certainly could easily have some serious pressure to the upside because it's such a very tight market. And one of the stories my father told me before he died was that Bunker Hunt actually visited our horse stud in New Zealand because he had horses. And me and Dad kind of shared a bit of a story on how they tried to corner the silver market, which was kind of nice in a way. Anyway, I mean, that's a market that could easily be manipulated. Actually, I shouldn't use that word. That could head in a northeasterly direction. So I remain positive on both gold and silver as a store of value, maintaining purchasing power. And for those prepared to take some risks, the gold and silver stocks on the market certainly offer some decent upside in the event of a discovery or moving into production. Uranium, a bit of a weird one. I put my clients into a couple of uranium stocks. I said that this is a bit of a contrarian place to be. And those stocks put on about 500-600%. And there was absolutely zero hype in the uranium sector. So it was a bit of a bull market by stealth. But after .com, I think it was about 2005, 2006, we had the mother of all uranium bubbles where suddenly we had 3 to 5 uranium companies. And then on the ASX, there was at least 150. So that again was a bit of a fad that followed .com. But I still remain cautiously optimistic on the uranium sector. I managed to get clients out of those two stocks that clearly outperformed and will look for a bit of a re-entry. The exploration stocks, I think, are probably your best chance outside of winning lotto. I look towards diversified exploration companies that have good management, good projects, and are backed by the majors that will contribute to joint ventures. Admittedly, the last couple of results I've had for two of my companies have been disappointing. And there's always a bit of a paper cut when it comes to that. But what I've noticed with exploration companies, even in the shittiest markets on the ASX, a decent find is always rewarded. And I think those might have seen a stock by the name of Chalice that was a bit of a Days of Our Lives stock. And what I mean by that is that you could tap it up and 6 months later, it'd still be 11 to 12 cents. That actually made a major discovery 80 kilometres from Perth and managed to go from about 12 cents to $1.09. And I think that's where the real upside is for those willing to take some risks. But it's certainly a niche sector. I'm much maligned because I'm keen to support that side of it. I know many people in the stock market don't understand exploration, aren't prepared to take the risk. But there are situations where your downside can be limited with good management, resources in the ground. And let's face it, one decent drill hole will probably get you out of debt and put your kids through uni. So again, I remain positive on the exploration sector. It works in any market conditions. You could have US markets correcting seriously, the Australian market correcting, and a decent discovery still gets rewarded. And in some cases, a lot of these stocks all overshoot to the upside. Looking at biotech, I remain extremely positive on the biotech sector based on the fact that the long-term impact of COVID will not be known for some time. I think that, you know, we've got people that have had the virus that are going to have a plethora of ongoing health issues. And I think there's going to be ways to look at future vaccines, how we treat future illnesses. And I think there's always going to be a market in the biotech sector. Again, I position my clients' portfolios with some biotechs that are of lower risk, and then we look at some stocks that we hope that will hit a home run with bases loaded. The other way to make money is to jump on a bandwagon early. We've seen numerous bandwagons pass. We've seen all this rubbish and fads suck in heaps of dollars and ultimately going to lead to some pretty serious losses, and more importantly, a loss of confidence among speculators. So as I say to clients, markets always revert back to fundamentals. It's a bit like music, which hopefully will always get back to guitar, drums and bass. So I think in the smaller end of the stock market at the moment, we are seeing reversion back to fundamentals, and that's how it should be. But I should let viewers know that we are currently saturated in investor webinars. We're saturated in announcements that don't mean much. We're saturated in resource companies with regurgitated assets. So to me, it's like turning up at 3 a.m. to a pisser holding a vegan pizza. You're not going to be popular, and B, you're extremely late to the party. And I've seen this in every fad market that I've advised on in the last 23 years. And I can assure viewers that this time isn't different. And here's something I found slightly interesting today. I grew up with my son and kids watching Peppa Pig. And I think that that's fantastic news that we now have American kids starting to act British. And perhaps as a result, we may have greater British comedies made in America. So I think that's probably one positive to come out of the pandemic. So anyway, I just thought I'd throw that in. I just found it interesting. And to end my slideshow, this will be the third time I've used this slide. And I know things haven't happened, but I think you all should read this and have a think about it. So I know with the Trent online dating, and you know, you get to go on that third date, and you know, ideally you should have got the Uber, but you want to be romantic. And you know, most bubbles in modern society end in IUM. And where it's lithium or other things, uranium. But I think sadly, with the way the world is, with the loose capital, with the extreme leverage that we've put in, these markets are sadly going to revert back to fundamentals. And in some cases, that's going to mean corrections between 30 to 80% that pretty much are almost guaranteed, even though the stupid money has continued on much longer than anyone would have thought. And it all gets back to, I was thinking about today, actually, when I made the bet with the kook, there was a couple of times that I actually looked like winning that property bet. And who would have thought that a global pandemic would have not only returned house prices to the June 2017 highs, but seen it overshoot that. And I'm not sure that I read anywhere that someone forecast a global pandemic, interest rates at 0.1%, but you know, a bet's a bet. I actually conceded that bet and asked for his bank account details. He didn't get back to me, so I'm expecting early next year that there'll be a bit of a media campaign and I'll look a bit stupid for a while. But I guess when I look at what's happening, you know, these are hard assets to get out of, and it only takes a couple of forced sales in a street and then suddenly a suburb has a 20% correction. So, you know, we haven't really seen the huge social impacts yet of what's happening. The government has provided strong support, income support. Businesses will get some help there with the lockdowns. But at some point, all these great new estates in East Dubbo, East Broken Hill, or East Alice Springs are going to be prone to some social problems. And I think that's a sad state of affairs as to where we're happening. So anyway, that's the end of my slideshow.
Tony, thank you very much. And as always, really insightful and, you know, raised questions as well. There were a couple that came through whilst you were talking. I'll just put this one up. You might want to have a look at it. And biotechs like Exapharm and Adalta being punished when they continue to release substantive positive news. Discuss.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. I'll deal with Exapharm first. It is my highest, well, it is not the biggest position I've had. And what can happen with some of these biotech stocks is that they'll undergo a pretty nasty technical breakdown where we did have people in at higher levels. They have been selling. There has been quite a large seller in the market. And people then get fearful, and without solid market depth, they do break down. So what I've noticed is that over the years, a lot of these stocks that go from 20 cents to multiple dollars at some point are going to halve, and especially it's not going to help the cause when the Dow drops 700. So, yeah, frustrating. It hurts. Out of my control, but I know that these types of falls do make investors nervous. And the other one, Adalta, actually came out with reasonably good news, but their drug was spending, it went straight to the liver. So they then said they now have to look at inhalation as a way of delivering it. And I think that pissed off some people who might have been expecting something else, combined with a bit of a drop on the Dow, and you get that correction. So what I reiterate, Martin, to my clients is at some point, some of your stocks are going to halve. We can't avoid bad nights on the US markets. Mind you, it was only down 2%. So what I say to my clients is, you know, you've got to get set. You've got to go all the way through. You've got to cop the punches, the bitch slaps. And at some point, your portfolio won't look that attractive. But I just think that's quite normal for this market. And you have to remember that we've just come out of June, which is a tax loss selling period as well. So a number of factors working against those stocks, which still remain fundamentally sound.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because, you know, there's always the question about whether you're trading or whether you're investing, right? And whether you're investing in fundamentals. And if you are investing in fundamentals, then you've got a thesis that says there is something here that could well be very valuable. But it doesn't actually be a linear process, does it, Tony? Quite often you find, you know, there will be people zigging when you might want to zag. But it's a question of that is very different from trading or indeed just, you know, running the volatility.
Absolutely. And some of my most successful clients are either sticking to that thesis or they're completely comatose. So, you know, you look at a company like Northern Star, which was 5 cents to $15. At some point on that journey, the Australian gold index actually lost 2/3 of its value and the small resource index lost 85%. And I think that we're all geniuses in hindsight where we could see the chart and said, oh, geez, I wish I bought and held that, which doesn't happen. But some of the best companies are going to have disappointing quarterly earnings. They are going to drill some dud drill holes and not all their clinical trials are going to work. So very, very tough. But a lot of, sadly, a lot of people get thrown by a forced seller, a fund that's forced to sell, throw in a bad night, and you feel pretty bad about your investment. But people that are in this speculative arena, you know, need to be mindful of that. And from my experience, every company that's had the right fundamentals and management has delivered, but would have halved multiple times along the way.
Yeah, and that's the object lesson, isn't it? You know, it's not linear. I sometimes say to people, you know, you might look back over the last 10 or 15 years and, you know, there's a couple of wobbles, but it's been a long way up. But if you look further back over history, it's tended to be much more up and down, up and down, up and down. I mean, I've lived through four major stock market crashes, right? Now, I'm a long-term investor, so I've ridden them through on the assumption that what I invested in were long-term stocks that will continue to generate momentum eventually, even if temporarily, you know, they sort of go off the boil. But you have to hold your nerve. And it's interesting how many people, I wonder, you know, a year plus ago when the stock market dropped, you know, from its highs significantly down, bailed out of their super, bailed out of the markets when it was down there, and then of course it went all the way back up again. If they'd bailed at the wrong time, essentially you wouldn't have benefited from you know, the fact that we're now back up to high levels, unless you were able to come back in quickly. But a lot of people mistimed that, and it's interesting, I don't know what you think, Tony, but I've seen it again and again. Quite often people bail at the wrong time in the cycle. In other words, on the way down, you know, that isn't necessarily the right time to sell.
It's funny how from being an advisor for about 23 years, every correction feels the same. It doesn't matter what event it is. It might have been September 11, might have been the tsunami, it might have been a car bomb in Afghanistan. It could be for any reason. But at the time, when your stock's going through that downside pressure, It always feels the same. But people should realise that every the Australian indices will continue to create record highs, and good companies will always have these strong performances. I mean, CSL, one point, was doing well, got whacked back down to $30. You've seen major corrections in Cochlear. But what I suggest to my clients and anyone who's interested is to source the book 100 Baggers and look at the journey some of these companies in the US had to increasing 100 times. So basically, 100 bagger is something you buy at $1 and it goes to $100. But these returns happen. And what I say to younger people is, you're 25 now. At 40, you're still young. Just give these stocks time. And a lot of people are thrown by a company that will have a year delay in getting into clinical trials. There's not many companies that go through those phases. So, yeah, you just have to ride the course. And if you're holding a load of rubbish, you might be holding crappy altcoins, you might be holding bandwagon jumpers in the ASX, you are going to lose 80% of your money plus. And that's it. That's just a fact of life. I know it sucks. But investors have to go through times where you're going to lose money hand over fist to learn a bloody lesson. And that's it. That's how it works, Martin.
Yeah. And in fact, that is the point. And I think some people who are perhaps earlier in their investing career have never seen this sort of dynamic before, right? And so it's completely weird and they don't know what to do. And unfortunately, you can make precisely the wrong moves at precisely the wrong time, right? Yeah. That's the truth of it. And, you know, I come back to my fundamental point. There are a lot of people who've been trading volatility. Look at Bitcoin, right? A lot of people have been trading Bitcoin, just trading the volatility, trading it up, you know. That is actually one way of trading in the market, but it's actually not often the best way. And yet, a lot of the big guys, and I'm talking here hedge funds, etc., are doing precisely that. And in fact, you know, one of the bugbears that I've got, Tony, is that there's so much liquidity sloshing around in the system. A lot of it's drifted to those big organisations. They're taking huge positions, right? The trouble is, of course, that they've got an advantage on average investors because they've got the ability to act more quickly and effectively get in the dark pools and get in before other people. So quite often, people need to understand that ordinary investors are always second-class citizens.
Yeah, and the level of computerized trading on the ASX, I don't think it's up to the 72% on the US markets, but I know I'll go into one of our stocks and I will try and buy a stock and suddenly there's 10 computerized orders on top of me and below me. So I know that people are out there playing golf that have set, or playing their Dungeons and Dragons, that have set these nasty algorithms to completely stuff up the market. But, you know, if you cast all that noise aside, there's still the romance of speculation. If you block out social media, you block out the bots, and you walk around with a AFR in your back pocket. I mean, they haven't quite yet killed the romance about speculation. But, you know, having these bikini models and porn stars promote investment classes, I think, is a sign of the times. But I'd say, you know, let's go back to being old school. Fundamentals will always win out. And this, you know, these fads are going to end badly, as Hamish Douglas said in that article.
Yeah, and, you know, I think I recommend everybody read his article. Don't necessarily agree with him, but he does make some very, very good points. And one of the things he did say was, you've got to think longer term, right? It's no good just thinking about the next 6 months or even 12 months. You've got to think longer term, right? Because there's a bunch of stuff going on at the moment, first point. And then the second one, his position with regard to cryptos, it could go to zero, you know. Now, other people will perhaps have different points of view on that. But certainly, there is no linear argument as to why the crypto momentum should be linearly to the, you know, to the skies, right? There's a bunch of reasons why you might have different points of view. And again, what I come back is, it's really important to get different points of view and different opinions from people, right? One of the things we try and do on DFA is not just spin one particular line, but we try and get different voices and different opinions and different ideas. Because the only way to actually make good decisions is to have a information base that's broad enough to be able to allow you to make those way up decisions. What I worry about often, Tony, is that, you know, some of these influencers just have a very, you know, monotone conversation. It's this is the way to get rich quick, right? And that's all they ever talk about. And to my mind, that should be the first sign of, you know, alert, red alert, right? Because frankly, if it was that simple, everyone would be doing it.
Exactly. And it takes me back to The Big Short, where they talk about fraud and mania. And I think, you know, what you're going to see now is that a lot of these influencers are being paid lots of money. There's a lot of underhand tactics going on. And I think that, you know, there will be royal commissions into all what is happening in these markets. But when it's all too late, it's like putting a Band-Aid on a shotgun blast. It's not going to stop the issue. And the good thing is that all these influencers and people with six packs and Ferraris actually stop people coming to me, because I can then offer a higher level of service, because I'm just happy to run at my own pace, get the results, get beaten up along the way, as everyone knows. But again, I'm not going to be the popular person at the prom. So that's just the way it is. And this time isn't different. It's just different mediums. But again, the greatest barrier to me getting business, besides my personality, is someone in a bikini. That's it.
Yes, don't go there. Yeah. Now, here's one from Cookie Boy, a first-class presentation from Big T. Which commodities does he see going boom as the auto manufacturers get on the EV train? Interesting question.
Yeah, it's a great question. And look, you have to take a look at cobalt, even though that there is going to be a move towards nickel batteries, as opposed to I think Elon Musk has said that there's going to be a great reduction in cobalt, but these changes in the batteries are going to take years to eventuate. So, I mean, the cobalt is a very liquid market, but it is going to be driven by production out of South Africa, which is a basket case at the moment, and more controlled production out of the DRC. So I still think that that market is going to be quite strong. The copper market will be traded around quite heavily, but you've got to remember now that most of the world's copper now is 4,000 metres above sea level and is under 1%. So there's going to be a lot of costly drilling to make the new copper discoveries. But I still think, you know, these commodities are going to be under pressure. Nickel is another one well worth a look. But again, I know where Cook is heading with that question, is that you've got to look at good resource projects that will work in any market. And I think what you need to do is stick with the company rather than the commodity. But, you know, the bulk of that lithium bubble, the easy upside's been won. But, you know, the lithium stocks have had a greater comeback than John Farnham or Anthony Mundine. I think whoever he's going to fight next.
Indeed, yeah, comeback time, yes. Somebody mentioned John Farnham earlier on, actually, in the chat. That's funny how those things come around. Now, one of the things I wanted to touch on a little bit was just back on property again. You touched on it in your main presentation. And it's worth just talking about the Perth market a little bit, right? Because there was a bit of a run-up, earlier on. But the Perth market looks to me to be easing back a little bit, and I suspect that's to do with all of the government stimulus being sort of turned down again. You know, all the homeland packages have been basically now sold. We also know that they're having terrible trouble getting builders, and so the construction cycle is extending like you wouldn't believe. And I did an update on Mandurah the other day, right, which is, you know, one of my sort of go-to postcodes, and it's quite interesting there because prices really haven't done much at all, and in fact going backwards in some cases, right, particularly for units. So the universal story of Perth being a booming market for property looks to me to be a little bit overdone now. What do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I've actually been following the market quite closely, and they came out with the top 10 suburbs, which said Salter Point, which was the best, which is, it's only, I think, 1.6 square kilometres. But interestingly, a suburb like Ascot, which is out towards the airport, still 20 kilometres from the city, was one of the best performers, along with Armidale, that Cabillo-Kelmscott area, which I've spoken about before, where you could pick up a house for 180 to 200,000. So they were the best performing suburbs. So I live in the Leederville, Mount Hawthorne area, where it's kind of like, think of Strathfield 10 years ago, but closer to the beach, much prettier area, where you can still pick up houses for about 1.2, 1.5. You know, that will be going for like $5-7 million in Strathfield. So I still think there's quite a lot of growth there. And the area where my parents lived, the agent said that, you know, he's getting people from Melbourne and Sydney just buying these houses without looking at them. And that area is about 6 kilometres from the CBD, has a great cafe strip. So his words to me was, it's just a case of catching a greater fool, because, you know, you could put your house on the market like I did at the peak in Perth in 2014, expecting a massive lineup, and I actually got donuts. Not one person showed up to the home open. And thankfully, we built a house that we knew someone else would love. So we chucked in a spa bath and some other features, and someone paid for it. But look, the Perth market is certainly tightening up. There's a massive delay with builders. I mean, some of these houses now are going to be delayed a couple of years. We've got more mortgage prisons by the beach going up towards Yanchep. So to me, again, look, it's more reasonably priced than Sydney and Melbourne, but historically it's still overvalued, and where the economy's heading, certainly downside risks, Martin. So it's not as hot as what people are saying, but hopefully, you know, some of these prices will continue for those wanting to get out. And But no, certainly not what people have made it out to be.
No, it's quite interesting how the real estate sector in various parts of the country have been spruiking, right? And when you actually look at the real data, as I do, even those big run-up in prices that everybody quotes, right, is mostly houses, and particularly upper-end houses, so quite small volumes. But if you look at the properties on the outer rings of a lot of our urban centres, and if you look at a lot of units, completely different story, right? And again, I find it amazing that the mainstream really don't differentiate sufficiently between those different types of properties, right? And then I look at the high-rise with all the issues to do with the construction defects and the flammable cladding. And in some cases, in some areas, I still see prices down 15 to 20% from where they were a year ago. And again, I don't see that reported anywhere either. So there is this sort of spin going on. I keep coming back to, you've got to go granular. You've got to look at the detail if you really want to understand what's going on.
Yeah, I guess if you run Atlassian, I mean, you can pay $100 million for a property. You can pay $75 million. You could pay $13 million for your spare toilet. I guess it's the ego-driven market where a super rich person could say, look, I'll live where the hell I want. I'll knock down that house, put what I did in the Daily Telegraph. And you start to see that being reported. But it's the real mortgage class where people have gone out, they've probably leveraged at 95%, not realizing that interest rates are about to increase and they're fundamentally stuffed, where someone with, you know, millions in the bank can just do what the hell they want because they think owning a lavish mansion with 13-car garage is going to make them happy. So, you know, if anything's taught me, Martin, I'm sick of preaching to people, but I live in a one-bedroom unit. I live well below my means. For me, happiness is a perfectly cooked steak, a great glass of red, and an attractive female who's into you, and you don't have to pay her. So that's my triangle of happiness. Not owning a mansion, you know. Fair enough, you know. Bloody live modestly. I don't know, but look, that's the side of the market where there's always going to be huge prices paid for someone that's got so much money that can do what the hell they want. But you're right. The unit market, Sydney, Melbourne, Gornskis. These houses with the brown bricks at the front, you know, they're looking at 50 to 70% corrections. And it's a lot of immigrants that are stuck in these places with no friggin' infrastructure, 2-hour commutes. I mean, shit, life's too short for that. I walk hundreds of meters to every facility I need. I'm less than 5 kilometers from the city. I'm close to Optus Stadium. I have a great life. And I just don't see why working class people today feel as though they have to have these huge mortgages to leave it all to their kids who can't wait for them to die anyway and probably don't like them. So I just think the whole Australian dream is going to shift towards the European model where people aren't afraid to live in a small unit and friggin' rent and go out and enjoy life. So I think this is going to be a bit of a fundamental shift, Martin.
Well, I've got this theory, Tony, we'll end up with 50-year or 75-year mortgages because that's about the only way to extend it, right? So ultimately, you'll have a mortgage, but really the mortgage is just like paying rent. You'll never own the place.
Yeah, no, I think it's this massive misconception, where prices have performed extremely well and they've made a lot of us housing realists look stupid, but it took a global pandemic to do it. But, you know, you look at Ocean Glimpses, a lot of the first things to get discounted when people are trying to sell their house to non-existent buyers is views, bowling alleys, pools, outdoor kitchens, which no one uses. And it's funny, you can drive around rich suburbs like Applecross and you will not see one person on their balcony. It's a fugazi, Martin.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'll tell you, there's a few things going on in the chat, which I'll come on to in a second, but I just want to pick up this one from Nigel first. What about investing in companies like Boxable? Now, I'm not sure. Is Boxable the package company? I don't know.
He's absolutely stumped me on that one.
Don't know. You'll have to, Nigel.
Be small houses? Could that be small houses?
It could be. I don't know. Never heard of it. So you'll have to explain who or what Boxable is.
Yeah, get Nigel to do that.
Yeah. Okay. We'll come back to that. But thanks for the super chat and Smooth. Thank you very much for the 175. There's a bit of an upward bidding war going on the super chat. I'm not wanting to stop it, but guys, thank you for your generous contributions. It is greatly received. And there's another one coming there from Russ. Thank you very much. It all helps to cover some of the costs of what we do here, so it is greatly appreciated. And it's quite funny was watching some of the conversations going on there. So one of the other questions that came up a little while ago, let me just try and find it if I can, was, okay, inflation. Let's just touch on the old inflation-deflation conversation, right? This is from Cybertech, the inflation-deflation debate in house prices. Inflation, everything goes up, bills go up, and afford more expensive houses. If deflation occurs, then houses surely go down. So I guess if you go back a few months, right, there was a very significant view that inflation was going to be a very significant force, and a lot of people were watching the bond markets and everything else. And then we had a bit of a change of tune. The central banks were saying, no, it's just, short term, it's just base effects. And I still think there. And I've been saying for some time, ultimately, there are deflationary forces which will overtake inflationary forces, right? And they're put at bay for the short term because of all this quantitative easing, money printing, liquidity creation, to the point now where if you look at the term funding facility in Australia, right, which is about $185 billion, right, well, the bank's got $185 billion from the RBA, but they've actually put double that back into the RBA because they don't know what to do with it, right? And there are reverse repos going on in the US where, again, liquid is going back to the Fed because the banks don't know what to do with it. So we've got to the point now where there's so much liquidity out there, it's not actually doing anything in the real market. Now, I would argue, don't know what you think, Tony, these are deflationary behaviours that we're starting to see here. And if that takes off, this is a whole new ballgame.
Oh, we'd be certainly turning Japanese. And we all know what happened there, Martin. But I think, as I said before, the good precursor is that upwards pressure on rates in New Zealand. The inflation figures out of the US were quite alarming. And I think that, you know, we do have a reasonably strong economy as per the figures with interest rates at 0.1, remembering that the long-term RBA cash rate is about 6.5%. So I'd actually put in an argument that we'll probably see stagflation first. Then certainly it's a case of inflation or deflation, but you've got three scenarios there which each one is equally as frightening as the other, but I'm certainly in the stagflation camp, which for those that don't know, stagflation is an inflationary recession, and you probably have to go back to the 70s where the US and Australia really struggled with it. But no, I can certainly understand your concerns there with the deflationary pressures, Martin, because certainly Australia doesn't want to turn into anything like Japan, which is pretty much a lost 30 years.
Absolutely. And, you know, I keep coming back to Japan, and I know that people say, no, Japan's different, right? Because, you know, we've got a different trade structure relative to Japan. We dig stuff out of the ground. They sell, you know, stuff that's been added value, and which I would say, well, actually, that's part of the problem. The other point, of course, here, Tony, is the China connection, right? Because of course a lot of what we have in our economy is digging stuff up and selling it to China. China is actively looking for other sources for iron ore and those sorts of things. So actually we've got a very narrow based economy here, and if you put on, you know, one end of the scales the iron ore and other resource sector and then basically the housing market, well, that's 80 to 85% of the economy. They're right on the other side of the seesaw, right? And that's why I'm much more worried about this, how it plays out, right? Because we don't have much else in the kit bag, unfortunately, on the economic investment platform that we've had over the last 20 years. And that's another reason why I'm afraid that I'm more on the deflationary side rather than the inflation side, because I don't see where growth is coming from.
Oh, no. It'll be certainly anemic with you're gonna have the construction industry is under a ton of pressure. We've got the travel service industries that are either going to have no travellers or a lot of businesses, like in Queensland, cannot get employees. So this is a very, what's happening is going to be extremely sad. And I just don't think that we're going to come out of this COVID with any real enthusiasm. I think that it's just become somewhat entrenched, and the constant lockdowns, and we don't know who's going to get locked down next. And yeah, I guess to some degree, Martin, your thoughts of no growth probably are going to occur, but how many interest rate increases are we going to see in the meantime, and what damage is that going to do to the confidence of the housing market, which is as fragile as that last slide I put up? So I don't think we've ever seen a more complex time in the economy with different views. I just think it's incredible. And it's going to make for interesting viewing.
Oh, I think it will. And there's no doubt in my mind that the Reserve Bank is still anchored to 2024 before they put the rates up, rather, the cash rate. But we're already seeing pressures from the funding of the banks, because the term funding facility is finished, right? So, that they are beginning to stir there, and some of the fixed rates are actually going up. And we'll probably say, and it's interesting in New Zealand, of course, New Zealand is now saying, well, we might actually see the Reserve Bank in New Zealand put the cash rate up in August this year, right? Now, that's very different from where they were even 3 months ago, 6 months ago. So these things can move quite quickly. And my theory is that if we start seeing rates going up in other parts of the world, and for example, Canada's talking about maybe they're doing something, some of the Scandinavians are talking about putting rates up, the pressure will be quite significant, not just locally on the Reserve Bank, but some of these international pressures, because the exchange rate will start to actually come into play here. Because if everybody dances the same tune and the exchange rates don't move around too much, no problem. But if things start to move and interest rates go up in one or two countries, that could really mess the exchange rate.
Oh, absolutely. And if I was in the RBA, if I was going to slap in an increase, it'd certainly be on Melbourne Cup Day. And I'd actually increase 0.15 to get it up to 0.25. And then they can maybe start with quarter basis increments before they hopefully won't have to lift it half. But that's what I do. I'd slip it in on Melbourne Cup Day when everyone has had an absolute skinful and are more focused on the fashions in the field as opposed to the price of their houses. Very interesting discussion. And I don't think anyone is really going to have the correct answer until we look well into the future.
No, that's right. Vanessa made the point there, term funding facility was a failure. Well, it does seem that way, because essentially they did use it to drive the rate down. So the rates definitely did come down. Look at the, the interbank rate. It's very, very low at the moment. But all that liquidity is now sitting on the central bank balance sheet, right? Yes, it didn't actually do what it was meant to do, which was to put money out and specifically give money to businesses to invest, right? The thing that I'm just find amazing is if you look at what's happened in terms of credit growth, the only credit growth that we've really seen has been owner-occupied housing and now investor housing, right? Bit of personal credit, but investment for businesses? No, it's nowhere around. And interestingly, that when I talk to businesses in my surveys, they talk about a lack of confidence. They talk about the inability to get the funding they need to be able to do the things they want to. So we do have a problem. We do absolutely have a problem with the strategy that's been used. It's very, very short term. Now, here's the next question then, Tony. With the lockdowns, with the new lockdowns coming through, is that going to then create another downward trough? Are we going to see another negative quarter of GDP? That means we'll probably get the Reserve Bank to throw more term funding facility money in, et cetera, et cetera. They might even take rates lower first. All of those seem to me to be in play at the moment.
Absolutely. And I think, with the extended lockdowns in Sydney, Melbourne, Victoria is still up in the air. Obviously, South Australia has just announced theirs. Yeah, it's certainly going to be very costly for these businesses. And I think the cost was, about $1 billion a week. So that's going to have a huge impact. and a lot of these businesses are only going to get some partial recognition for their losses. But yeah, it could put a drag on the economic figures after we had such a strong snapback. So I just think that not only is it going to dent what's coming in, I think certainly going to have a huge impact on confidence and our confidence to go out and start spending money. I just think that, you know, people probably would have thought that this COVID, the worst of it would have been over, but no, it's certainly turning into a scary situation. And again, you know, you've got a time where a lot of asset classes are at record highs, and the employment situation for a lot of families is going to start getting quite precarious. So again, there might be some more emergency actions to take place, Martin.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wouldn't be surprised to see some. I mean, APRA has already, for example, allowed the banks to class loans that actually have been put back on deferral as okay loans. In other words, not in default again, right? APRA just came out with that today. So they've already provided yet more support to that. And I said last time around, you know, all of this stuff is fundamentally bank keeper, right? It's keeping the banking system there, right? We don't want to see property prices fall because that will put too much pressure on the banks. We need to actually get people to continue to borrow because the banks need to continue to lend. I mean, all of this is, well, very narrowly yeah. based, I'm afraid. Oh dear. I won't go on. I will say this though. I don't know whether you saw this. Late on Friday last week, the House of Lords published a report talking specifically about quantitative easing, right? And they were highly critical of the Bank of England. And they basically said two things. One is the Bank of England's quantitative easing program was more about generating cheap funds for the government than it was anything else, firstly. Secondly, that there was no exit strategy for quantitative easing, so how to get back out of it, right? And sidebar, the Treasury tried to block the inquiry from the House of Lords and didn't really give them very good support because the Treasury didn't want to admit that they were in cahoots with the Bank of England. Right now, I think we've got the same trouble here. I think we've got the Treasury and the RBA working together. But you got to say, quantitative easing is not necessarily something which is going to be positive for us as we go forward. And again, the question I keep having is, no one can give me an answer, how do you unwind it?
Exactly. And you got to look at the purchase of debt, the purchase of struggling assets. I mean, how long can you continue this process? And you know, I can understand that the concerns in England. You've got countries trying to manage their balance sheets, where you've got the RBA that are trying to manage a speculative real estate bubble, as opposed to the economy. And that's been the argument for some time. I mean, what do they do? Do we start to see these short-term inflationary pressures? Do they have the balls to lift rates? Because, you know, it's going to be quite a shock to the system that you've got to look at the long-term figures and mortgage rates. The average is more in the nines than in the high ones and twos where we find them now. And people are saying, well, this time is different. Yeah, maybe in the short term with all this quantitative easing, with all this government support, but economies eventually are going to revert back to normal. And you've got people that have taken out 25, 30 year loans with hideous amounts of leverage. They're going to find that rates could potentially double or triple and the value of the asset will halve. And I keep using it, Martin. It's the economic equivalent of being sandpapered to death.
Yay! Well done.
Got themselves into.
Well done. You've now completed your bingo card. I was waiting for the sandpaper to death. Congratulations.
Awesome. Is someone going to super chat?
No, I was just keeping a quiet record here. I've got my list on the bingo card. I was ticking them off as you went through, but I thought we were going to miss the sandpaper tonight. But well done, you've now got the full set.
I must be like the Rove McManus of one-liners. I've just got to get some new material. I apologise to the audience that I'll come up with some new sayings.
No, it's fine. I think it's fun and hilarious. I just like playing the bingo. You know, it's really good. Now here's a question from which I think is quite interesting. This is from Think Help. Ask Tony on his thoughts on ESG, environmental, social, and governance in his investment choices. Is that a lens you look through, or do you look round it? What's your thoughts, Tony?
Oh, that's a question that I've been going through in my compulsory educational requirements. Look, I always look at social governance quite highly in relation to the environment. I guess, you know, we've got to look at the environmental impact. Obviously, is to do with mining, and often, you know, you might have a rare frog that holds up a mining operation, or a Mediterranean moth. So I think a lot of those times you need to overcome progress as opposed to a rare insect that no one really cares about. But, you know, to be honest, in relation, when you look at the ethical side of things, people will say, well, I don't want to be involved in gambling stocks. I don't want to be involved in this. But to me, I just look at a good company that keeps its standards up, that can make clients money. But I guess we've got lots of moving parts going around as well, Martin. So yeah, ESG, I do look at it, but it doesn't guide my investment decisions, because a lot of these new wave investment opportunities will amount to absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, very good. You know, I sometimes think about the old Shakespeare about, you know, signifying nothing, right? So it's all this noise, all this everything else, but what does it really signify at the end of the day? Okay. Oh dear, it's an interesting question. There's quite a few others, but Nigel just came back with Boxable. I'll just put that up. It was the idea to build houses fully fitted out turnkey. So basically, I guess it's some, you know, prefabricated, unitized housing, and it is used in all those sorts of philosophies, are used in a number of other countries. Because in fact, if you look in Australia, statistically speaking, it takes about three times as long to build a house here in Australia compared with some other countries around the world. And of course, time is money. So yeah, in theory, you know, that might be an interesting thing to explore.
Yeah, I think I read recently about a company that was building small houses that went under, and in a big way. And I guess it all gets back to that argument. Do people that have made a lot of money on their property want these houses anywhere near them? You know, similar situation to inviting social housing or government supported rental schemes. So, I mean, yeah, maybe in an far outer mortgage prison, you might be able to have that. But I just think that we're going to go back into more the higher density housing. But to me, yeah, whilst that sounds great in theory, it is going to have an impact on house prices, which a lot of people won't want.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's definitely a challenge. And, you know, one of the things that I come up to quite often is to just think about the trajectory we're on. Look, if the momentum in property continues, right, the question is, at what point does property become completely unaffordable, right? Because we've got larger proportion of income going at the moment on property, and people say, oh, it's cheap because rates are cheap. Well, yeah, but look how big the mortgages are, you know, 15% bigger for first-time buyers, right? We've got this trajectory which is just crazy, and all this quantitative easing is essentially allowing this bubble to froth even higher, right? And what you said earlier on, I think it's really interesting, Tony, when you said even when things are falling, they can fall further, right? Well, I would argue when things are rising like this, right, there's much more chance that they're going to start falling rather than just turning around and rising even higher, right? Now, you and I both believe that property is well overvalued, and we know it from a debt ratio, and we know it from an absolute ratio perspective. But, of course, everything is supported by these programs, quantitative easing programs, the government stimulus packages, the promise from the Prime Minister that house prices won't fall on their watch, all of those things. That's the context. And then, of course, we've got migration and everything else, which, of course, is also up till now quite recently supported it. So we've got all these factors. But the fundamental question is, at what point does property become completely unaffordable? Because we're getting close to that.
Well, you look at the price to income ratios at the moment, which are probably around 12 times in Sydney, correct me if I'm wrong, and you look at a market that's been permanently overvalued for years, which has been Hong Kong, where I think they pay 20 to 22 times. But come back to a beautiful city called Perth, Martin, where the ratio is closer, it's between, the price to income is between 5 and 6 times. So what we're seeing is a speculative bubble, mainly in Sydney and Melbourne, where the median price of Sydney now is about double that of Perth, whereas you're living in a, admittedly, you've got the Opera House and the Harbour Bridge, but you're living in a congested city and, you know, you have to live 50, 60 kilometres out to afford anything decent or with space, whereas you look at Perth, Brisbane, Adelaide, which have been traditionally slower performing markets, where there's nothing wrong with them, that do have that lower price to income ratio. So I think that what's happened is the eastern states has become completely out of kilter with the rest of the country, and it's just fueled the mother of all speculative bubbles, and positive price action begets positive price action. But I just can't see it getting towards a Hong Kong at all. And I'll keep reiterating the point that it only takes a handful of forced sales in a suburb to give a good real estate agent what's called price discovery, where they can start to see prices lower in that suburb. So look, that market on the eastern seaboard is extremely fragile. We've got pockets in the other capital cities on the fringes that are fragile as well. So I just think that what's going to be the pin that pops it is simply going to be an exhaustion of buyers, an exhaustion of hype. And you've seen that certainly in the more speculative stocks, and in particular on the crypto markets, once Elon forgot his Twitter password.
Yes, we won't go there. Now, here's a question, which is actually quite an interesting one. This is from Javier. I'm in my 20s and looking for a career change. What industries in Australia will prosper after the next deleverage, in Tony's opinion? Renewables? Energy? You know, I think it's a really interesting question, because we have to find a growth engine beyond the ones we've got. Where would you look, Tony?
Well, you're going to see the emergence of the hydrogen industry. That's due to a number of junior companies, and Andrew Twiggy Forrest has made moves in that regard. So, you know, there are alternates such as wind, solar, geothermal. There was actually a geothermal bubble in Australia about 15 years ago, which again only tore up a heap of institutional money and amounted to nothing. But I think what we're going to see now is that people are going to need, I think you've got to look, perhaps towards renewables, but I think also what's going to become alarmingly obvious, Martin, is that people are going to actually need financial counselling, financial advice that's going to go on for some time as well. And I think that there's going to be a lot of trepidation in the travel industry. I guess, you know, people trying to become a pilot, you know, there's certainly going to be some barriers to that. You look at the service industries as well, such as nursing. There's probably always going to be demand for that. You know, I'd never go back to the police because, I had too much fun in that. But it's just interesting as to where the jobs are going to come from. And I think eventually it's going to get back to tourism in this country once we almost rid ourselves of this virus. So that's a very tough question. And I guess a lot of people can simply go and do a Bachelor of Arts and then make their mind up after that.
I love it. I love it. One of the two people asked about property prices when the borders open, right? And I guess that's a function of more migrants coming in or not, right? We've got way too much supply of property relative to the current market demand in Australia, despite what everybody says, right? And I'm fascinated by everybody saying, no, build more. But no, we don't need to build more. That, of course, is a call from the politicians who want more land released so that they can get more taxes. And there was a 66 billion number I saw, which is the stamp duty that the states have benefited from over the last decade, thanks to all this property cycling and, you know, upcycling. So there'll be an incentive from some quarters to try and grow the property market and grow the prices, right? Except I don't think the migration necessarily will perhaps play the way that people expect. And I've got this theory, I don't know what you think, Tony, that, you know, if prices do settle, they might settle for quite a long time. And if you take the longer view of history, and I think you've had a chart in one of your previous shows that showed that over the long term, you know, property prices don't do that. They tend to sort of do that. They follow inflation. So if we do start getting some settling of prices later, it could be a long, slow stagnation in terms of property values.
Yeah, there was a chart I put up that that said if you bought at the top of the land bubble in 1890, it actually took you to after World War II to get your money back. And that is the actual real housing price, which includes inflation, and also allows for improvements to the property. So you could have, I just hope to hell we don't get that 40 to 50, 60 years of stagnation. But I wouldn't expect that. I would expect something maybe more akin to what happened in Perth, you know, six to seven painful years, prices 20% off their peak. So I guess it's a heavily fragmented market where you've got the ego-driven prices, but then you've got the mortgage class, you've got people in the outer suburbs. So look, I'm expecting it to do what Morgan Kelly says, and in every bubble, 70% of the gains is lost, which means that, you know, 500,000 to 1,000,000, and then 350 grand of those gains are lost, and you end up with the price at 650,000. So, I mean, that's the frightful studies that Morgan did. He was right about the Irish property market. I know that this is dragged on much longer, but it doesn't mean that those who are more realistic about prices are wrong, because you're dealing in an illiquid asset class. And I guess it's, you know, it's the press that keep the ball rolling, keep these bullshit stories flowing. When the correction really occurs, it's exactly like a lobster or prey pot. You've got to get out. The transaction costs are huge. The settlement times are huge. And it's going to be an absolute economic shit show as well. So, look, I know it's dragged on, Martin, but doesn't mean that we're wrong. And it doesn't mean that we're going to get that soft landing at all, because, you know, you if you become a student of speculative bubbles or the economy, you'll know that it always reverts back to the mean, and in some cases overshoots to the downside. And when you see a headline on the Daily Telegraph saying the end of property, or property will never recover, that'll be the time to buy. So, yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, it is absolutely okay. One last question, Tony. We're nearly on time. You were buying into the concept of the US market falling, right? You actually were, I think, with BBS, right? Mm-hmm. Are you still holding that, or have you changed your tune on that just as we come to the end of our conversation?
No, that's a great question. What I've managed to do for the first time in a few years is get myself a paper loss. Based on that, yep, I did go too early. I have dollar cost averaged into it. The S&P 500, Dow Jones has certainly gone against me. But look, it's not in a bad way, because I look at that instrument as a form of insurance and having ready access to money, because there's always a market maker there. But what I actually have done, Martin, is increase my bet against Australia. And I've actually bought some of the BBOZ, which are trading, I think, at about $4.70 at the moment. So what I've said to my clients is that you've got a speculative portfolio. 90% of that should be in the high-risk stocks, but you also need 10% downside protection from major indices. So, no, I've maintained my stance on that. But, again, you know, dumb money can go on longer than what we think, and, you know, to the upside and both to the downside. So, you know, last night we had a 700 point down night. They're gonna certainly come, but historically markets are grossly overvalued and they are gonna correct, and then at some point they're gonna become undervalued. So no, I certainly maintain my stance on that, Martin. I'm not changing my stance on property or the economy or anything, because it goes against me. And in the short term, if you look at Christian Bale with his drum kit on The Big Short, I mean, he was getting smashed for so long. And then suddenly, you know, it's the trade of our generation. So, you know, you just got to stick to what you believe in. And that's all I'm doing.
Yeah, great advice, Tony. And I want to say thank you very much for your time tonight. Great to have you back on, and sympathies from all of us with regard to your personal circumstances. Really good to see you coming back, and very interesting, very informative, and always as provocative as ever. So thank you once again. And I'll look forward to picking up the conversation, you know, down the track as always. Always more to talk about.
Yep, absolute pleasure. And thanks to the viewers. And despite my personal situation, please don't think you have to go easy on me in the comments section. Yeah, fire away. I'll live.
Believe me, Tony, they haven't. Thank you very much. I'm going to take you offline. Right. Have a good evening. And I'll just close out the show. See you later, Tony. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Night, everyone.
So there you have it. Great show from Tony, as always. Massive insights there. And what I like about Tony is straightforward, to the point, and he still holds to those fundamental principles, which I think is a really good thing. Right. Well, we're pretty much done. Just a couple of announcements. Next week, the show will be with Damien Klassen, and Damien and I will be talking specifically about from here where, given all the changes in the marketplace. So that should be an interesting conversation as well. So mark your diary for that. And I did see somebody a little while ago asking about getting Steve Keen on. I do have an appointment with Steve Keen to make a show with him. It's about the third week in August. So watch out for that. That'll come as not a live show, but as a recorded show. And I think that that'll be worth it. Also, keep track of some of the other things we've got on our channel. A lot of new shows coming. And I want to say thank you very much indeed for all the support, for all the super chats, all the questions. We didn't get to yours, and my apologies, but hopefully you enjoyed the conversation. And I look forward to seeing you all next week for yet another show. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.